Welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us have a passion for just taking a walk. Walking for 5 months and covering 2,000 miles across Europe from London to Jerusalem, the Just Walk marked the centenary of the Balfour Declaration, in which the British government announced their support for a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. In this episode, Andrew Stuck catches up with Justin Butcher, who conceived and led it, who describes the Just Walk as a pilgrimage of penance and a march of solidarity. Crossing the Alps by the St. Bernard Pass to northwestern Italy was rivaled in its beauty by the Albanian countryside. Accompanied by groups of walkers of different faiths and nationalities, a core group walked the whole distance, meeting refugees making journeys in the opposite direction and being welcomed as celebrities by Palestinians. It's an extraordinary undertaking, chronicled by Justin in his best-selling book entitled Walking to Jerusalem. The interview takes place on a cold winter morning along the Parkland Trail from Finsbury Park to Highgate Woods in London. Okay, so a walk that took how long in all?
5 months.
5 months to do the walk.
Yeah.
How long to prepare it?
Goodness me, 2 years. It was a 2 year preparation period from the time that I conceived the idea of a walk to Jerusalem to mark the anniversaries of 2017 and then pitched it or mentioned it to my friends at the Amos Trust, and they decided they were mad enough to go with it and they wanted to do it. It was about 2 years in the planning.
And how did you choose the route that you took?
It was a great kind of adventure burrowing into the labyrinthine world of pilgrimage and long-distance walking. My first point of contact in that world was my friend Penn Haddow, the polar explorer. I took the idea to him and I just said, look, just advise me, please, on this. Do you think we can do it? And he said, of course you can. Why shouldn't you? And do we need to train for months and months to get... No, not at all. Just do it and you'll build up the stamina as
well,
you go along.
I mean, I was about to say, the distances you were walking each day, how did you calculate what you would do there? Was that based on where you might stay that night?
Well, it was partly dictated by accommodation, but it was also that the walk was bookended by these two huge anniversaries in the Palestinian struggle. So we decided that we were going to leave London on the 10th of June, which marked the 50th anniversary of the conclusion of the Six-Day War in 1967 and the beginning of Israel's military occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank, East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. That was the day on which to set off, 50th anniversary of the occupation. And obviously the day on which we wanted to arrive in Jerusalem was the centenary of the Balfour Declaration, the 2nd of November. So we worked out, we'd got to do about 2,000 miles within that period. So from Penn Haddow, the polar explorer, and he put me in touch with a fellow called Harry Bucknell, an explorer or long-distance walker, former soldier, who walked the Via Francigena from Canterbury to Rome.
Now, that's a route you did follow quite closely.
Absolutely. And Harry wrote a book called Like a Tramp, Like a Pilgrim, which is an echo of a phrase from the prologue of Patrick Lee Fermor's Time of Gifts. That. And he said, well, obviously you want to follow the Via Francigena because it's waymarked and it's half the route, you know, that you want to take. You know, and it's also, that is the route that pilgrims to Jerusalem from Western Europe would have followed from ancient times, from Canterbury to Rome, and then from Rome down to Brindisi or somewhere like that, and then probably they'd have got a ship to Haifa. And then Harry Bucknell put us in touch with Ian Broderick of the Confraternity of Pilgrims to Rome and to Jerusalem. Their mission is to rediscover, to uncover and bring back into use the labyrinth of ancient ways which crisscrosses Europe and Asia Minor since the earliest Christian times. And so we used, in the end, with the wonderful advice of all these different people, you know, they would say, this is the sort of distance you want to be reckoning on doing in a day. I remember Ian Broderick saying, well, I can do 45 kilometres in a day. would I want to? Particularly in the heat, midsummer heat of southern Europe.
I'm going to say you would probably not.
I
mean, Patrick Lee Thermal, he sort of started in December.
Yeah.
You're choosing to start in midsummer.
Yeah. And I suppose also that it enabled a lot of the walkers who came in to do different parts of it to sort of treat it as their summer holidays.
But nonetheless, I like the idea that you have
relay.
People coming in to join.
Yeah,
no, definitely. And maybe we better just do a little snippet on what is the walk, the Just Walk to Jerusalem.
But, I mean, in terms of the route, this process of refining the route and also the distance, the appropriate daily distances, the likely temperatures we've been encountering, this kind of thing, took all these wonderful and interesting conversations to research over a 2-year period. And it does introduce you to this fascinating world of pilgrimage, which is still there. This is absolutely wonderful. That if you choose, for example, to walk the Via Francigena, and you pick up your pilgrim passport in Canterbury Cathedral and get it stamped, all the way along the route to Rome, there are places of hospitality, pilgrimage houses, abbeys, monasteries, jeets, you know, where you can claim hospitality as a pilgrim, in theory, for free. Now, I mean, I think in reality, they would like it if you pay, you know, and if you can afford to pay, then you should pay. But so we decided to follow the Via Francigena, how wonderful, a waymarked path through northeastern France, Switzerland, over the Alps, at the Great St. Bernard Pass into northern Italy. And obviously it would have taken us down to Rome if we'd followed there, but we weren't going to Rome, so we diverted at Piacenza in Italy, just north of Tuscany, down the Via Emilia, a Roman road heading down to the Adriatic coast and to Ancona, and then ferry over the Adriatic to Durrës in Albania. And that's where we picked up the second major route, the Via Egnatia, which is the original Roman road all the way to Constantinople. And thrillingly, there are many stretches of it where the original paving stones are still able to be seen, you know.
I like that little piece where you said that it's sort of like the Roman centurion doesn't walk in step because otherwise 1,000 men will destroy the infrastructure.
That's right.
The rhythm of their steps.
Iron-shod.
They do different types of steps.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So we're walking along. I've noticed you're swinging one arm, not both arms.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, are you a sort of metronome walker? Do you find you get into a kind of...
We're naturally walking in step now, aren't
we?
Yeah. And I guess that's an interesting thought to ponder, isn't it? I wonder whether as animals we do that partly to be in sync with each other so that we're on the same team, so that if a bison or a woolly mammoth appears, we can defend ourselves together. But maybe also, is it to limit our footfall or something, you know?
I don't know.
The saber-toothed tiger can't hear us. I just don't know, but it's absolutely fascinating, the synchronicity. They say, don't they, 80% of human communication is body language.
The kind of process, I think, of walking side by side is almost hardwired into us, I think. You know, it's sort of like we don't have to think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
We just fall into step, don't we? That's quite an old expression.
Yes, indeed.
And what a lot of people talk about is that walking side by side, you actually build trust and share intimacy much more rapidly.
I agree.
So, you've spent 5 months walking with groups of different individuals, but there have been some you've walked a lot of that time with.
Mm.
Don't you get to know each other rather...
You do.
In the first morning.
Yeah.
And then by the afternoon you've worked out you never want to walk with them again.
Yeah.
How did that work itself out? I mean, all that business of developing a kind of a community, a temporary community of passionate people.
Yeah. Well, I think it was a small, everyday walking miracle. It was absolutely remarkable, the sort of love and solidarity and mutual support and respect and good humour which emerged in the core group, and which then participants who came in picked up on and joined in on.
And they weren't shut out because it was a sort of little cliche.
No.
Oh, we're in the core.
No.
You haven't actually put in the miles.
That's right. You'd think that could happen, wouldn't you? But it was extraordinary how the core group sort of opened itself like a flower opening, you know, one of those evening primrose flowers that opens. It sort of opens itself to incorporate 15 newcomers, you know, who were coming to do the crossing of the Alps or something. And then it could easily, quite comfortably contract again afterwards. So then the nine core walkers, you know, would, over the course of the day, be spread out over hundreds of yards,
you know, or different
groups or whatever, you know, and engaging with new people. And I don't want to romanticise it, because I think that walking together, as you've just said, and pilgrimage is a sort of microcosm or a model for human community and interaction. And, of course, you work out within minutes, you know, of meeting for, oh God, he's a bit spiky, or this person seems a bit shrill, or you know, bossy, or something, you know. And of course, you also work out to whom you're going to gravitate naturally.
Yep.
Now, I was one of the leaders of this project, so I didn't allow myself the luxury of just hiving off with the ones that I naturally like. So I felt that I had a sort of pastoral responsibility to befriend and get alongside everyone in the team, partly because, particularly for stretches of the walk where I was the sole representative of the leadership apparatus of the Amos Trust, you know, and I was holding the money, the credit card, the emergency arrangements, all of those sorts of things, I had to be an available figure, someone who was there for everybody. I made it a kind of personal rule that I would walk a part of each day with everyone, and that particularly if there was somebody who wound me up or rubbed me up the wrong way, that I would make a point of walking with them and chatting and finding something that we had in common.
Yeah.
Because I thought, you know, if I'm experiencing a strong antipathy to someone, irritation, whatever it is, what better opportunity in life to experiment with the adventure of companionship, you know, than now? Why not? Maybe there is a miracle waiting to take place, that if I persist and if we, you know, we walk together and find something we can talk about, I might start to like this person. And I don't want to overstate, for all my friends on the walk who are listening to this, I don't want to overstate negative feelings. You know, I'm being semi-serious here.
Yeah.
You know, that there was obviously nobody that I detested. There was nobody who really rubbed me up the wrong way. But we all just have our own temperament and our own natural.
But that also chimes very well with what the Just Walk to Jerusalem, in part of the sense you talk about the thing that I can never pronounce, ambulatory...
Ambulando solvitur.
Okay,
yeah.
Which means...
It will be solved by walking.
And it's a lot to do with suggesting that one of the ways out of the conflicts, that one could walk and talk, and walk and talk, and perhaps walk and talk something to resolution.
Yeah.
I think it might take a bit more than that, but
it will take more. But you're absolutely right, and that sort of sense of trying to be on a daily basis, no doubt failing a bit every day, but trying again, you know, trying to be a kind of community of total equality and love, hospitality, support, mutual support, friendship, good fun, and of celebrating our freedom to walk across Europe and the Middle East, you know, this glorious freedom that we exercise politically. It's almost impossible to imagine any other period in history when a group of people such as us could have walked unimpeded across a whole continent.
Well, that was the other thing I was going to ask, is that you obviously met people as you were coming into southern Italy and Albania, who were refugees trying to get, and Greece trying to get into Europe.
Yeah.
I mean, it's difficult to encapsulate, and you've written it very well, but, you know, what's the... You know, what's the kind of essence of meeting these people?
The answer which is springing to my mind, for example, those lads, teenage lads that I met in Thessaloniki. Oh, dear. Sorry, it actually makes me feel very moved. Just thinking about it. Those teenage lads from Syria that we met in Thessaloniki, they were at a sort of refugee educational project called Arsis, funded by various EU member states. And these two lads were about 15 years old, one from Aleppo, one from Homs, and they were both refugees. And I was with a friend who sings in Arabic and plays the oud, and we went into the centre to do some music in Arabic. And so my friend Julia was playing the oud and singing Arabic songs to them, and these lads were singing along, and then she was interviewing them on my behalf in Arabic and translating, and I just thought they could be my own boys.
Yeah,
I felt a deep surge of affection and warmth for them, wanting to protect them and sort of do something for them. And I thought, well, I would be proud to have either of these boys as my son, and they are, you know, to a reader in the UK, or if I'm talking about it anecdotally, it all sounds very foreign.
Yeah.
Oh, you're in a refugee project in somewhere in Greece with these two Syrian boys talking in Arabic, but the point is, they're not. They were just like my own sons, and so
that must have been really quite difficult to know that you had to keep going, because you had a mission.
Yes.
And the mission was building in its impact and gravitas every kilometre you walked.
Yeah, that's right, because we were in touch with our sort of partner organisations on the ground in the West Bank, the Holy Land Trust in Bethlehem, the We Am Reconciliation Centre also in Bethlehem, Al Rawad Youth Theatre in Ida Refugee Camp in Bethlehem, a group called the Right to Movement, Palestinian Walking Association called the Abraham Trail, the Masar Ibrahim Al Khalil, who are opening up a new walking trail from the northernmost to the southernmost point of the West Bank. So all these different organisations we were in touch with, and the Holy Land Trust, which is led by the amazing Sami Awad in Bethlehem, is a very close partner of Amos Trust. And so they were our hosts, our fixers on the ground. They arranging everything, arranging all of our visits and our meetings and our walks and everything. And there was great excitement building about all of that. And then through October, of course, walking through Greece, Turkey, and then Jordan. I mean, the temperature started to hot up in the media and the international community in relation to the Balfour centenary. Theresa May made a speech in the Commons about, you know, how Britain will be celebrating the centenary of the Balfour Declaration with pride. Britain is proud of its role in creating the State of Israel. And, of course, the reaction of Palestinians up and down the territories and the diaspora was of total dismay and astonishment. And what was always more moving and tragic, in a way, was this feeling of disappointment. They expected more from us. The mayor of Sa'ir near Hebron is an example of this, where even after 100 years of betrayal, dispossession, injustice, suffering, they still look to Britain as a benevolent and civilized great country that sort of gave many good things to them, and they expect more from us. And that there was a deep feeling of betrayal. And I've written this in the book, that I wished I had Theresa May with me there in the South Hebron Hills, in that flapping Bedouin tent with a 70-year-old Bedouin farmer, crying out in Arabic, why? Why is she celebrating?
What is there to celebrate?
And that she was going to attend a festive dinner in London with Netanyahu and with the current Lord Balfour and the current Lord Rothschild, to whom the original Balfour Declaration was, or to his ancestor was written. So our arrival in the West Bank, when we finally made it through, we couldn't possibly have anticipated the impact that we made. It was absolutely overwhelming and astonishing. I mean, in a nutshell, we were treated like superstars everywhere we went. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, I hope that doesn't make it sound vain. That wasn't the point, you know. That wasn't why we went. We went primarily as a pilgrimage of penance, as a group of British people representing the three faiths of the Holy Land, people of other faiths, people of no faith, Buddhists, you know, agnostics, everything. But British people walking 100 years after Britain gave away the rights of Palestinians and gave away their land without their consent, to say we are sorry for the actions of our government 100 years ago and for the 100 years of tragedy and suffering which Britain's actions have caused to your people. For what it's worth, we're very, very sorry. And to show how sorry we are, we've walked all the way.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from Justin Butcher. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we would love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited. Our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.